Welcome to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamic. With Balsamic mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcast the easy way at simplecast.fm. This podcast features Matthew Milan, CEO of Normative, and his presentation, Making Moonshots, from August 10th, 2017.
Floor, ladies and gentlemen, Matthew. Whew. So, let's get started. Today, we're going to talk about making moonshots. I want to talk about what people try to do with moonshots, why they do them, and how you can deal with these types of projects to make them successful at the level of an organization you work in, whether you're a startup or, in a lot of folks' cases, larger organizations. This is Paul Pangaro. Does anyone know Paul's work? You totally should. He's awesome, he's interesting, he's a designer, he's also an actor, and I think he's the last person in the world to get a degree in cybernetics. He wrote this amazing book with a couple other folks, Hugh Dubberly and some other folks, about 15 years ago for Sun Microsystems, when Sun was trying to go through this time of extreme change. And it's called The Little Gray Book. I'm not going to put up the URL. You can Google Little Gray Book Leadership. You'll find it. It's a PDF. It's totally worth reading. It's like Zen cones for design leadership. They're really quite good. But this is my favorite quote out of the book. And it's one of the things that's going to tie my entire talk together, which is this idea that leadership is the reduction of uncertainty in an organization. Okay? Leadership is not somebody at the top barking out orders. Leadership is not the folks on the ground doing emergent stuff. Leadership is the reduction of uncertainty in an organization. And as a member of a team, regardless of whether you're the CEO and you're part of the executive team, whether you're the director of innovation, whether you're a junior designer, whether you're an engineer challenged with being more creative, this is a big part of your job. So the question is, how do you help reduce uncertainty? And that's what we're going to dig into a little bit today. And I'm going to give you my thoughts on some perspective principles and practices for dealing with innovation challenges, and specifically the types of innovation challenges that a lot of organizations are starting to go through these days. So what's the job we're going to talk about here? What's the job to be done? I think it's really quite simple. What you want to do is create confidence by reducing uncertainty. We're going to talk a little bit about how the tools that you have as designers and engineers and innovators can help you create confidence, provide that leadership capability in organizations that are doing really challenging things. So here's the takeaway for today. Remember this. This is one of the key points. Good innovation is risk management. It's not taking wild and crazy bets. It's not going and doing flights of fancy or things like that. It is managing risk. It is managing risk in the face of doing something very risky. I think one of the best definitions of a moonshot is people trying to solve a complex systems problem by creating a complex system, which is bonkers. Which is bonkers, but most moonshot projects end up in that domain of solving a complex problem by doing something complex. And so your job, from top to bottom in the organization, is really to help reduce the risk. Doesn't mean take things safe, it means reduce the risk. We're going to talk about that. So the question is, how did I end up being a designer who cares about risk management? I'm going to talk to you for a couple minutes about how I got there. But 9 years ago, I started a design firm. We're about 30 people. We do all kinds of interesting things, and for many years, that's all we did, little interesting things. Like a lot of small shops, there was a lot of passion, but there wasn't any thread to what we did. So about 3.5 years ago, we said, let's really try to take this whole Silicon Valley idea of product market fit to heart and actually figure out where a real need is for design services. Design shops were being acquired, design shops were being closed, it was harder and harder to differentiate yourself, and that was what I was hearing from my peers who were running design firms. And so, very selfishly, we said, let's go find a niche, or as we say in Canada, a niche, which is the proper way to say it. And so where did I start? I went to Silicon Valley, and I got as many meetings as I could with the design partners at various venture firms. And they said there's all kinds of challenges with designers struggling with this and struggling with this, and we can use help with this, and we can use help with this. And everyone I talked to kept telling me all these really interesting but known challenges. And then I went to one design firm, one venture firm, that didn't have a design partner. And I had this customer development conversation with them, and this is what they said to me. They said, designers don't get scale. I was like, wow, what does that mean? And he said, you know, when engineers go through school, all the labs they do, all the practices they do, everything else, it's all about like making something work at scale. From the beginning, they think about shipping something a million units. I'm going to build it so that as soon as it goes out, it can like do this. Amazon, AWS, do all these different things. Marketing, very similar. It's all about growth. It's all about scale. Designers are thinking of one-to-one relationships. This is where their point of frustration was. And so I started going and talking to other folks who would hire designers, started branching out, not just talking to venture firms to understand what their portfolio problems were, started going back, talking to some of our clients, and then people who could potentially be our clients. And we spent a couple of years doing this customer development work, really trying to understand where the needs were, where the challenges were. And at some point, we started going down the rabbit hole of doing an ethnographic study on what our potential clients would look like. And it got really scary really fast because we got quotes, this variant of this quote, about a dozen times. These are C-level executives, these are VPs. I'm on the phone saying, like, what really, really freaks you out about designers? This. And as we dug in deeper and refined more and more and more, the answer became clear. It wasn't about scale. It had something to do with risk. And there was a really big offset between how a lot of designers were trying to solve problems and what the people who were in charge of these problem spaces were trying to do. And so we started going, oh man, we just spent like the last 6 or 7 years like trying to do like cool imaginative stuff, and like everyone's telling us like, we've been scaring you folks. Worst was when a client we've been working with for years, I was asking him about this, and he said, yep, that's my biggest fear with you folks. Like you're gonna come in and go off the rails, and you're gonna like do something without planning and all kinds of other things. And I was like, oh shit. Anyways. So we really started thinking about what's going on here and really stepped back and tried to empathize with the leaders and organizations for the first time, the people who were responsible for products. And then as we got more focused, where the problem seemed to be, the people who were responsible for innovation, the VP level people, the SVP level people, the C level executives, the folks who are really dealing with big innovation challenges, or as we'd like to call it, the existential threat. So, you've all heard the stats about the average Fortune 500 company lasts about 15 years right now. There's a lot of reasons for that. But as we talk with large organizations and talk with senior people, the challenges that they face are very significant. And their stakeholders, their shareholders, their leadership, their boards have competing views of the world, and these individuals are trapped. They're supposed to deliver results on a quarterly basis. The COO is trying to goose gross margin, the CFO is trying to drive profit, right? Head of sales is trying to drive revenue. All these things need to go up every single time. And at the same time, they're often in a place where their new competitors, the folks coming into the market, are disrupting them. And it's very challenging because what these folks increasingly need to do is not make the business better incrementally, but while they make the business better incrementally, they need to figure out a way to replace the entire business with a new, better business that's more defensible and more successful in the next 10 to 15 years. They have to get a new business out of the old business. And that's why they start to get into these places where they start thinking about moonshots. And this crazy amount of risk, I need to figure out how I run my existing business and create a new business to defend against all these new market entrants or organizations that actually create new markets, because that's where the real threats are. I need to figure, if I'm the CEO, I need to figure out how to do that in the next decade, and I might not even be around and I have to set the ship in that direction, I have to chart the course. That's scary for them. And then, you got your teams saying, check out all this cool stuff. And they're like, you're going off the deep end. I'm trying to like solve this massive business problem, and it doesn't seem to fit, even though on both sides, the intentions are always extremely good. And so this is why risk management matters, because the folks you're trying to help, whether they are direct or indirect, you might be two or three levels below the CEO, you're still helping solve that problem around the existential threat. How do I create a future business that allows me to satisfy my shareholders, my stakeholders, whether you're consultants or whether you're internal teams? Risk management really matters. And so that's why moonshots happen, because at some point, some organizations say, we really need to make a change. We really need to go after something different. And so somewhere in the bowels of the organization, a little tiny idea starts to evolve, and it goes from small rocket tests to 15 years later, somebody trying to land a spacecraft on the moon. And that's a crazy, crazy bet. So essentially, what you have is you have these leaders charged with setting 10 plus year goals where they don't even really understand the outcomes that they're going to get. They only understand the direction, and they're trying to help the entire organization go in a certain way. I was very naive when I was a young designer. I used to think that CEOs were stupid. I used to say, like, they say the same simple stuff time and time and time and time again. Like, can't they think about this stuff at the level it needs to be thought about? What I realize now, after having been a CEO for years, is that saying the simple stuff really matters, and the repetition is everything. Because what you're saying is, by the end of the decade, we're going to put somebody on the moon. By the end of the decade, we're going to put somebody on the moon. By the end of the decade, we're going to put somebody on the moon. Because you have to take your team of 10 or 100 or 100,000 people and get them to march in the same direction. And your message has to be simple, it has to be on point, and it has to be something that everybody can look up to and remember, this is the reason why the organization exists, or this is what the organization is trying to become. And so these types of statements really matter, and people will often say, oh, that moonshot feels crazy, it feels off. You have an executive who is trying to deal with a huge amount of risk, and what they really want to do is get everyone marching in the same direction. And that's one of the things that I'm going to hopefully help you start to understand today. Let me just see here. How are we doing? This is an important thing to understand, by the way. And is vision or fear the driver of your moonshot? And our hypotheses, and basically what we have in terms of qualitative data right now, is that it actually doesn't matter where your CEO is a visionary or they're scared to death. In either case, the legitimacy of the moonshot is the same, and it's your job to help them. And so if it feels like it's a defensive position, you still need to dig in, you still need to really push. And if it feels like it's a conservative approach, you need to understand that the individual that is leading this and the individuals working for them are really, really trying to get to that 10 or 15 year goal that allows them to sustain the business for the next couple of decades or the next decade. So it doesn't matter whether the person you're in the room with is inspiring you and you have a C-level executive or a VP innovation who is excited about everything, or whether they're tense and nervous and pushing back on everything. In either way, they're trying to achieve the same goal, and you need to empathize and understand that they're not doing it to be difficult, they're doing it because that's what they feel. So moonshots, quite frankly, are probably one of the scariest and riskiest things that a business can do. A lot of them fail. And in a lot of cases, people are motivated by the reward, but underestimate the risk. And when you're a designer and you're working on a project to figure out what the future of something looks like, this is probably pretty close to your decision set. What's possible? And then the canonical, how might we do it? This is really good, this is great thinking, but you also need to understand that the C-level decision set or the executive decision set is different. They have very different questions that they need to be, that they need to have answered by your prototypes and by your work and by the reports that you share about the research that you did. They need to understand this. Can we do this and should we do this? And that's very different from saying, let me just pull this back here. What's possible and how might we do it? They're not incompatible, but what we discovered is that a lot of design work, a lot of innovation work is being framed up around what's possible and how might we do it, and then it hits this place. And you have somebody say, can we do this? And the designer says, I don't know. the confidence immediately goes down. Go back, figure it out. So you try to figure out a better outcome. But what we see again and again, internal teams, external partners, these questions are not being answered in a way that satisfies senior leaders. And it's not just answering the questions, it's answering the questions in a way in which they can absorb the information quickly and make good, confident decisions with it. Let's talk about actually making moonshots. And specifically, I want to spend a few minutes demystifying the moonshot. One of the best moonshots in the world right now is this one. How many people put money down for one of these, the Model 3, or alternately know somebody who put money down for Model 3? Yep, there you go. My co-founder stayed up all night the night that this was happening just so he could do that. He didn't tell his wife. That was an interesting conversation in the morning. Hey, honey, I bought a car online last night. It's going to be here in 3 years. What Musk has done is Musk has essentially completed a moonshot in front of everybody else over the last decade in a space where most American bottle manufacturers have gone bankrupt. I think it's only Ford. I think it's only Ford and Tesla that haven't gone bankrupt as American auto manufacturers. And they did it from a startup with three or four people. And let's take a little look to how they actually did that. So Elon tells us, right on his website, August 2nd, 2006, that's 11 years ago, he says, check this out. He says, what I'm doing here is I'm trying to help expedite the move from a mine and burn hydrocarbon economy towards a solar electric economy. This is my moonshot. My moonshot is to change how the world uses energy. And then he says, here's how I'm gonna do it. I'm gonna build a little sports car. I'm gonna use that money to buy a more affordable car. I'm gonna use that money to build an even more affordable car. This man clearly understands cash flow, because he's funding so much of this himself. And while he's doing that, he's also going to provide zero-emission electric power generation options. And then, cheekily, he says, I'm not going to tell anybody. That was a decade ago. He did it. And he did it in some very interesting ways. And we're going to dig into that stuff a little bit. So let's talk about principles for bootstrapping a moonshot, so you can understand how good ones work, and you can understand how you can support these types of things. Here's the first principle. Don't start from scratch. So Musk, with a very small team, went out and built the Roadster. That was the first car. He didn't go and put together 50 or 60 people and build a prototype from scratch. He subcontracted out everything that he possibly could to organizations that knew how to do these things already and focused on the tougher things, like the battery, for example. So Lotus actually built a lot of the Roadster. He also set high-level goals, not the detailed plan. You saw his plan. It's like four bullet points. That's usually something you see on Slashdot, where step four is profit. It's really simple here. And this is really important. Set the high-level goals. Don't set the detailed plan. The detailed plan will kill you, and we'll get into that in a little bit. Break it into small steps. The small steps matter. This is about climbing a rock face. This is not about a big jump. You want to go up step by step. You want to leverage yourself up. You don't want to get yourself into a place where you're taking big leaps. This is critical, and we're going to come back to this in a little bit. What you want to do is address the big risks as early as possible. And when you address the big risks, you need to address them across as many dimensions as possible. And to the question that folks had about engineering, this is why it really matters that you have good, integrated, interdisciplinary teams. You need the designer and the engineer and the marketer going out and in parallel with a single prototype, testing the technology constraints, testing the design opportunities or the user constraints, understanding what the market size is and how we actually might get traction in that. So you can go into the room with a leader, or more likely, arm the person that you work for with the ability to go into the room with a senior person and have them say, here's how we can do it. I know this is going to work because we already did a test on your Korean telco APIs, your Korean telco partner, their API, and we can get 10,000 concurrent connections a second. We tested that up front. Why do we test that up front? Because we know that the type of product that you're asking us to build is going to have to do that later, and we want to know on day one or week two whether you're going to be in a place to actually do that. And that leads to this idea, which is you really want to understand how to prototype your way into production. That doesn't mean that your prototype becomes the production piece. That means that the thing that you're building, the learning tool that allows senior leaders to make great decisions, yes, that prototype totally makes sense. I'm glad you tested it against that API so that we can understand concurrency. You're going to get very different types of outcomes in the room. People aren't going to say, this is great, this is cool, I love it. They're going to say things like, hey, head of product, take these ideas and put them into the Q4 product development pipeline. Those are the types of answers you want. That's how you move the moonshots forward, is you get the prototype ideas into production as quickly as possible. And that's not about giving the classic information that you collect as designers only. It's answering the can we and should we. And what I see a lot of organizations do, and I think it's probably the single biggest challenge in large-scale innovation projects, is they defer risk. Who remembers the 2008 financial crisis? Yes. Innovation projects, and especially moonshots, are rife with these types of challenges. The risk of deferring risk is probably the biggest reason for the failure of these types of projects when a lot of them could be successful. Donald Rumsfeld, love him, hate him. He's got some really great quotes which he stole from other people. Let's talk about the risk of deferring risk. Number one, survey says, you don't know what you don't know, so don't pretend that you gloss it over and solve it later. Because when you try to solve something later, you push that unknown into the future. You know what? We can like totally mock this thing up in InVision. We can go talk to the engineers later, and we can go figure out what concurrent connections looks like 6 months down the road, or that's their challenge. I was in conversations early in this year with one of the world's biggest banks and talking with members from their different innovation groups. And we got them all together in a room, and we were having some conversations around their prototypes. And they were showing us this prototype, and they were talking about the fact that they're really struggling to get traction and move it forward with their executives. So we said, hey, we'd love to like have the next meeting with the engineering team. And they went dark. And about 3 weeks went by, and we were like, what did we say? Did we like do something to like completely offend them? And then this email came back, and the meeting got set up, and everything was cool, and we went back to visit them and sat down in the room with the product people and the innovation people and the engineering team that happened to be dealing with this API platform that was being developed. That, by the way, all the future products in the innovation pipeline in this massive innovation lab were 100% dependent on, and the assumptions were that they would work. And it turned out that nobody from the innovation team had ever talked to those folks. And the reason it took so long to get the meeting together is because they had to figure out who they were and convince them to come to this meeting and all kinds of other things. Crazy, right? This is a company that has 200,000 plus employees and surely has crazy institutional knowledge. They invent a lot of the stuff that you see in modern banking. And yet the innovation folks were completely disconnected from the technology folks they're going to be dependent on. And then we learned that the prototyping work had been going for about 15 months without looking at this. Yes, 15 months. We all laugh. Some of us have been there. I guarantee you will all be there at some point. And this is why I want to tell you this stuff, so that you can make better decisions. We said to the folks who were setting up this API, we said, we think that we can help you folks get unstuck in about 2 weeks. We'd love to get access to the API and have our designers kind of like try to like build a little thing on top of it, do a couple of experiments just to see how we can get things moving. Like, sure, no problem. Go register. Took us 2 weeks to register, even though it was an open public API, because nobody had registered for it. We were the first folks to register on this. And the reason why I'm bringing all this up is think of all the unknown that has been pushed into the future with this type of stuff. This API is being built to serve all these different needs. This prototyping work has happened. These massive investments in teams and partnerships and everything else around the future of banking have been poured into this. And you're at least 15 months in, and you're there. And so what you see is your exposure to the unknown, it compounds. And this is where it becomes like bad debt. And this is, as designers, as innovators, this is where you can stop this stuff. You can start to understand that we could have had a one-hour meeting with the API team on week 3 or 4 of our project as opposed to week 75. And we would have known very clearly early on where things were going. We could have managed that risk. But now you're in a situation where the things that you build are going to come up and be shown separately to some senior decision maker, and they're not going to be able to answer, can we or should we? And so you hit a system level block. We're still talking with that organization. They're still stuck because the block is so big and it's so challenging now that moving it is a political nightmare. It's a financial nightmare. No one can back away. And so when you get into this type of situation, you can't afford to go forward or back. Imagine if the Apollo program had gone into a place where the engineers and the systems people and everything else weren't working together as an integrated unit. What would it have looked like if you'd spent 10 years on this and ended up with a bunch of parts on the ground? What if you couldn't even get to the moon? What if you couldn't even break orbit? What would that have done for the national psyche? That's what failed moonshots do to organizations. And that's why it's so important to help reduce ambiguity as you do this. So, how do you stop this? It's really simple, I already said it. You want to test your biggest risks first. Don't defer them, don't push them back, don't short sell them, don't say, we'll just like touch that on the surface. Take the biggest risk that you can see in the project and hit that first. And that's hard because sometimes, often, it's not a human-centered design risk. It might be a technology risk. And it's your job to help understand the interface that I might build for this isn't going to be able to run 10,000 concurrent instances at the same time or not. Now, the name that we've started to hear for this type of perspective, and there's a great blog post on Medium about this. It came out about a year ago. It's called the RAT test. We love the name. And it stands for Riskiest Assumption Test. So this is what Rick believes, and I agree. The problem with the MVP is it gives you a false reassurance of a clear linear path. We'll talk a little bit about this. There is no clear linear path to the outcome. To assume that assumes that you know all the risk ahead of time, and that's ridiculous on any type of complex project. When you go into testing mode and you test more than just do users like it and can they use it, but you test all the different assumptions, you get into a place where the focus is purely on learning as an organization. And to the folks who were asking that question about how do you get engineers involved, a big part of it is understanding how you can learn together. How can you, as a designer, think a little bit more like an engineer? How do they learn, and vice versa? How do you put the focus on learning? How do you move forward one step at a time? You know, the moonshot, everyone goes, you put people on the moon. It started by putting chimps in orbit, right? Small steps, put a chip in orbit, bring them down, put another chimp in orbit, put a dog, put a person up for 15 minutes, put a person up and orbit them around the planet, put 2 people up and have them do a spacewalk, put 3 people up and send them around the moon, put 3 people up and have them land on the moon. Test, 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 test. Remove assumptions, turn them into information, turn them into things that you know so you can build confidence that you can do it as a team and in support of the organization. Now here's something that as designers you absolutely need to start to think differently about. Not only are your great ideas not precious, you need to kill most of them. So I have a problem with traditional critique. I don't believe that the point of critique is just to make things better. The point of critique is to understand whether this thing is going to fit in the context of what the organization or the market needs it to do. And those are different questions. I want to talk about the room. There's always a room. You may not ever have access to that room. You may never hear about it. There's always a room. I had a talk a couple of months ago with an individual who was one of the early employees at Nest. And I was asking him, you know, what do you think Nest went sideways? And he said, I think it was this. Tony Fadell had this really ratty, little tiny windowless conference room off the side of his office. And that's where we would take ideas to go and get them killed. And Fadell, Tony Fadell was ruthless. He demanded all the different questions we're talking about, can we, should we, be answered in the room. And if they couldn't, it was dead. It was back to the drawing board. It was all about killing things. This actually comes from, the earliest roots of this come from NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Having a room, and originally it was called the Risk Assessment Board or something like that, and they eventually became called murder boards. You might have heard of murder boards. Murder boards were originally set up to solve these types of really challenging problems. How do we make sure that we don't mess this up? Well, we have to be ruthless. And the majority of ideas that we're pursuing need to be shut down. And the sooner we can shut them down, the better we can shut them down. I've been talking a lot of theory here, so I'm going to talk you through a little example of something that we helped the British government solve about 2.5 years ago, which I'm going to call the beer and broccoli problem. So the British government has this very interesting welfare system. There are people who spend their entire life on welfare in the UK, and that's part of the social fabric. It loses billions of dollars a year, and for all kinds of different reasons. People are unbanked, the money gets actually delivered in like cash or checks, hand-delivered, all kinds of things like that. People don't even have like formal addresses. There's all kinds of places where the system leaks. And one of the places where it leaks really badly that's really hard to track is what they call the beer and broccoli problem. The beer and broccoli problem, really simply put, is you give money to parents. They're supposed to spend it on broccoli and shoes for their kids, and they go spend it on beer. And so the disbursement of the funds that the government expects don't go where they expect it to, and that's a loss to them. And so big UK bank and the Department of Welfare and Pensions came and said, we need to figure out in 6 weeks how to convince this British lord that a contactless payment system based on blockchain might help us solve the beer and broccoli problem. We were like, what? How do you do that? What do you do in 6 weeks? So, very simply, using these principles, we looked at what are the biggest risks? What are the biggest challenges here? We said, we need to figure out whether we can make this work with existing near-field communication payment systems. It has to work with the existing world from the start. Otherwise, they're not going to buy it. We have to be able to post deposits from the government and transactions to people on some type of ledger system so they can track it. And then we have to figure out how to put rules into money so that somebody, when they scan this, can figure out, the system can say, hey, you're supposed to spend that on broccoli, not on beer. Now, I know there's all the surveillance implications and all that other stuff, but the UK invented surveillance society, so they're totally cool with it. That's what we learned. They invented the police state. They're all good. They're all good. You can direct all the moral and ethical questions to them, although we had many debates about that. Our questions that we wanted to help this British lord answer in the room. Can we do this and should we do this? And not because they were going to implement the entire thing, but because if we got that gatekeeper to buy into it, they were going to run a 30-person pilot on that. And so that's what they did. We helped them understand that you could tell whether you're buying beer or broccoli, you could post that to a specific type of technology in the most basic way, these pieces all can work, now we can have a team go and build out a bigger prototype. And so they just finished up the 30-person test, and now they're heading into a 1,000-person test. And if it keeps going this way, in a couple of years, the moonshot of putting the British welfare system on a blockchain is gonna work. Part of that was understanding how do we reduce the risk. Let me talk about another example really quickly. Similar scenario, large organization, we'd worked with them for years. They were trying to figure out the future of television. They'd put about $450 million into this project from a technical perspective and everything else. They came to us and said, okay, help us figure out what the user experience is going to be like. We want to innovate. We've invested all this money. Now we have to beat Netflix and all these other things. And so that's the work we did for them. And it was fantastic. Yeah, it was fantastic. As we went through this, we learned over and over and over. People want this, people want this, people want this, people want this, people want this. Why did they write down a $500 million investment last January? Because the Korean telco could only run 10,000 concurrent hits at a time, and they need to run 100,000. That should have been tested the first couple months into the program, not year four or five. And so deferring the risk has billion-dollar consequences. So let's be really straight about this. What do you need to do? You need to change your strategy, and I'm going to make it really simple. Innovation is a search problem. You're searching the space for the best possible opportunity to help your organization. And everybody loves the pivot, right? You dive in, you start doing all this really interesting stuff, you learn, you pivot, you learn, you pivot, you learn, you pivot. That's amazing when you're a small team in a funded startup where you're agile enough to change direction every single time. You can recover a lot of your waste in terms of what you're doing. You can make it work. For large organizations, it's almost impossible. Doesn't mean that you can't be agile. You have to think about it differently. You have to think about it not like a startup, but like a venture firm. It's a portfolio problem. Take the riskiest assumption. Test it first. Move it forward. As soon as it fails, go back and start where you left off. Where was the last time we were successful? Do it again until you hit a point of failure. And what you start to learn is that as you take all the risky assumptions off the table early on, you get better and better and better at getting to a point of success. And when you're doing great design work on new products and things like that, you're fundamentally trying to help senior leaders answer these types of questions. Can I find the best possible idea using the tools I have as an organization to make that work? And so you need to reverse engineer what to do next. You need to look into the future and understand what's my biggest risk now. You need to think about how can I prototype in the real world? Envision's great, but if you can work with some folks who can work with the front end or the back end, the more real you can make it, the more you can answer the can we, the more you're going to be able to help answer the should we. You got to kill the bad ideas fast. It's not about saying, hey, we know that doesn't work, but let's give it another shot. If it doesn't work, it doesn't work. Take it off the table. Try some other opportunity. There's lots of opportunities in your search space. Don't keep trying to polish one that doesn't work in the hopes of getting it right. You run the risk of writing down $500 million. And then understand that your real client here is the room. It's Tony Fadell's room. It's the room where things go to die. Your job is to make the decision makers in those rooms, whether it's you, whether it's people you work for, other folks, give them the tools to make the best decisions so that the very small number of ideas that make it through are truly transformative, truly bulletproof, and actually have the potential of returning that. So essentially, what you're trying to show folks is that you can share the risk and help them reduce the uncertainty, and that's how you can lead as a designer in a moonshot scenario when you're working on something that's risky and there's uncertainty and everything else. Every single decision you make, every single design choice you make, everything that you do with a partner, it's all about sharing the risk by reducing the uncertainty. So let's talk really quickly about the practical implications. How do you actually put this to work? It's really simple. Same tools, different questions. Use Sketch, use Envision, all your other tools that you're used to. Ask those questions, but in your repertoire of questions, you're going to add two new ones. You're designing something. Is it possible? How can we do it? Can we do it? Should we do it? Number two, you're going to start to channel the C-level. What's the pressure like on somebody who has to deliver quarterly results and return the value of the business in 10 years? Right? And then finally, the final point, and I think the most powerful one, if a picture is worth 1,000 words, your prototypes are worth 1,000 pictures. The decisions that get made around a tangible thing that answers questions across many dimensions is way more powerful for a leader than a screen or a mock-up. And the closer you can make that prototype in terms of covering all the different types of risks, the better it's going to be. Doesn't mean it has to run for 100,000 people. You can have it run on 5 concurrent users and say, we did a test to load up the server structure and see that we can run 10,000 at a time. So don't throw out your tools. Add new questions. Understand that the folks making the moonshot have significant pressure and risk on them, and it's your job to help them lead by reducing that risk, and then give them the tools that encapsulate your thinking and allow them to make great decisions. And that's what prototypes really allow you to do. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Chicago Camps 2017 Prototypes, Process, and Play Design Leadership Conference podcast, sponsored by Balsamiq. With Balsamiq mockups, anyone can design great interfaces. And in partnership with Simplecast, publish your podcasts the easy way at simplecast.fm. Learn more about Chicago Camps events on our website at chicagocamps.org.